It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up in Wisconsin Life, we'll learn about a sled dog race in Bayfield that attracts mushers and dog teams from all over the Midwest and Canada.
First, a national conference in Washington, D.C. on Friday could change the way policing has been done for decades. Almost 200 law enforcement leaders attended the conference where they created guiding principles about how police officers use force in the line of duty.
Jeffrey Albert attended the conference, and he's here to talk about it. He's a professor in the Department of Criminology and Criminal Justice at the University of South Carolina. Jeff, welcome to Central Time. Jeff, are you with us?
Good afternoon. How are you?
Good, thanks. Well, a big part of this conference is looking at what are being called new guiding principles for how police work is done. In a broad sense, what kinds of issues are on the table here?
Well, first of all, these are not new or innovative standards or guiding principles, as they call them. These are really things that have been around for quite some time. The value of the conference was to bring approximately 200 police chiefs together to discuss how to achieve them. And I think that you ask what they were. A lot of it is having to do with diffusing potentially violent encounters, has to do with using empirical data or using evidence to make decisions, requiring officers to have those courageous conversations when other officers are getting out of hand. I mean, things that we know, we've looked at, that a lot of departments do, but a lot of departments just haven't done it well.
Is a lot of this, or any of it, I guess, being driven by this national conversation we've been seeing unfold about the relations between police departments and, for instance, minority communities?
Well, of course. I mean, a lot of this was discussed in the president's task force on 21st century policing. A lot of these guiding principles can be found in the consent decrees that the Justice Department has been working with certain cities, including Ferguson, Cleveland, New Orleans. There are a handful of them that have very lengthy and specific requirements from which a lot of these principles can be drawn.
So it sounds like you're saying these are not new principles. These are things that have been in place in many instances already. The question is how to implement them. So another question off that is, why aren't they not being implemented already? What's happening?
Well, that's a good question. I spoke with several chiefs there who kind of shrugged their shoulders and said, we do this. But I think if everyone were honest, sitting around the table, many of them would do many of the ideas. Not all of them would do all of them. So your question is spot on. Why not? And I think a lot has to do with money. I think a lot has to do with priorities. One of the requirements is to be transparent. Not requirements. Guiding principles is to be transparent when providing information. There's a big controversy today in American policing about releasing police officers' names who've been involved in shootings. That's not something everyone does, but then again, you look at the Dallas, Texas, you look at their website, not only do they announce the names, they list all the reports. So every report on a police officer-involved shooting is on the Dallas website. I think they're in a minority of agencies that do it, but still, it's something that other departments should follow.
We're talking with Jeff Alpert right now from the University of South Carolina, talking about a national conference in Washington, D.C. that is looking to change the way police work is implemented and maybe is done. And so, Jeff, looking at the de-escalation tenet that's being part of this conference, how would that go about? How would police departments go about implementing that, making sure that is the practice that's emphasized in that police department?
Well, one of the things that we talked about and has been on the table for quite a while is what's called procedural justice. And this means that police officers should give all of us as civilians, the idea that what they're doing is fair, what they're doing is proper, and they give us a voice before they make a decision. And while that's an important concept, it's something that isn't done all the time. So getting officers to slow down, perhaps, and if there's a threat, create distance and cover equals safety. And instead of rushing into a situation, backing up. Now, police hate the word retreat. So, you know, we can be creative. We can call it tactical repositioning. We can call it whatever we want. But the bottom line is slow down. Don't rush things. People react poorly when they're rushed, but all of us do. So if the police officers can be trained and understand why it's important to slow down, I think we're going to see a lot more successful encounters than we do today.
And what about responding proportionally? I know that's another big topic on the table there. How would that go about? How would police departments use that one?
Well, that gets into a very heavy legal question of proportionality. In other words, should police officers use force beyond the type of offense the person is suspected of committing? And of course, officers should use force only as a last resort and should use the least amount of force. So the discussion is the proportion. What is this person wanted for? What did he or she do? And it gets into one of the things that they talked about, not shooting at fleeing cars. Shooting at a fleeing vehicle is one of the most dangerous things a police officer can do, because even if he hits the intended target, now you have a car that's unguided and can go anywhere. But proportionality is something that officers need to understand, that we as a public need to kind of get them to do, and particularly dealing with people who are suffering some sort of a mental crisis. That was a big part of the conference, is to deal with people who are having a mental crisis.
Sounds like police in Scotland have been held up as an example for officers nationwide in this country. What's the parallel there?
Well, what the police in Scotland, and I've got to say, in some parts of England, and particularly in Australia and other countries, where they don't have a gun problem and they don't have a violent citizen problem, the world's a different place. And yes, we had some officers from Scotland who came over and showed some training videos. But again, it's things that we all know. The big difference is the propensity for us Americans to carry weapons compared to the Scottish. They will not confront hardly any guns during their policing, and very few knives compared to what our officers do. So it's a less dangerous job, and how they respond is different. But their model is impressive, as is the British and Australian model, where officers will not assume there's a knife and will not respond with the concern, and they're able to perform much better.
What sort of compliance and acceptance do you think that the takeaways from this conference will have in police departments across the country? Do you think that in general police departments are ready to take these on, to try to implement them? Or is there a sense that, as you say, we know all this already, but this is a dangerous world and there are a lot of guns out there?
Well, I think it's an interesting question. Do the police themselves? And there was a really interesting book put out in the 80s called Who's Guarding the Guardians? And it was by the U.S. Civil Rights Committee. And just about a month ago, not even a month ago, the Fourth Circuit put out an opinion on a case in which a taser was used on a mental patient who was hugging a pole. And basically the Fourth Circuit, which is by far the most conservative circuit in the United States, Federal Circuit, basically said, since the police don't police themselves, we're going to have what we call judicial rulemaking. We're going to make rules for the police. And I think this is where the police departments across the country have to be very careful. If they don't do it themselves, if the police don't institute a lot of these reforms, if they don't listen to what the best practices are, unfortunately, the courts are going to come in and basically tell them what to do. And I think that would be a real tragedy.
Well, what do you think can be done to encourage law enforcement departments to adopt and to follow these guidelines?
Well, I think progressive departments do. I think and certainly in Wisconsin, you have a lot of good progressive police chiefs. We see them all over the country. The problem is we're fragmented. We have over 18,000. We don't know how many police departments we have, but it's over, the last figure I heard was over 18,000, many of which have 10 or fewer officers. So our fragmentation is horrible. So we don't know what one department's doing.
Jeff, you still with us? Well, thank you to Jeffrey Alpert there, professor in the Department of Criminology and Criminal Justice at the University of South Carolina.
Mushers and their dogs take to the trails this weekend for the Apostle Islands Sled Dog Race. Julie Buckles fell in love with dog sledding and then watched her daughter take off in the sport.
20 years ago, I stood on a wintry main street of La Pointe on Madeline Island in freezing, blowing, below-zero weather for the first ever Apostle Island Sled Dog Race. My boyfriend Charlie and I watched a handful of mushers take off into the blizzard and then darted into the only bar open for business to wait for their return. I was new to my relationship, to northern Wisconsin, and to dog sledding. 5 years later, my now husband Charlie presented me with a team of huskies for my birthday. What I really wanted was a baby, but that wasn't working out. Charlie says he didn't get me dogs to fill the void. He just wanted more options for winter wilderness travel. Regardless, I suddenly owned a kennel of adolescent Siberian huskies. On our first outing, the dogs took off at turbo speed. Charlie gripped the handlebar. I sat catatonic in the sled. Somewhere along the wooded trail, I hollered for him to stop. Charlie did, but the team had other ideas. While Charlie and I argued over our options, the dog snapped the line and bolted without us. We found them an hour later, tangled and on the road. We continued to get schooled, and are still getting schooled, in worn-out snaps, group dog dynamics, wooden doors, plastic buckets, and harnesses. For example, Charlie missed taking off Shaggy's harness after a night run, and so Shaggy ate it. The result? A $773 vet bill for harness removal. And as these things often go, 1 year after that first outing, I was pregnant. Raising and handling kids and dogs soon got tangled into one fast-paced ride. Caroline took her first dog sled ride in utero. Once she was born, she rode in my arms, enveloped in blankets. Once she could sit, she would ride in the sled, first alone, then with her younger brother. At 9, Caroline announced that she wanted to run in the Apostle Island Sled Dog Race. She had never run dogs alone, and the race was only 2 weeks away. We'd stayed involved with the race, but as volunteer handlers, not competitors. I said yes. And so I stood with Charlie and my son Jackson at the starting gate, watching as Caroline, who didn't weigh much more than a bag of dog food, flew out of sight. I replayed all that could go wrong until one long hour later, she crossed the finish line. Last year, Caroline participated in her third race. She lost her team when they took off after a red squirrel. Caroline's friend and fellow racer Greta passed by and offered a ride. Powered by four dogs, the two of them flew down the trail until they caught up with her team. Caroline took third place, Greta first. Girl power meets dog power. There's little logic to having a team of sled dogs. Having a kennel is money and time, noise and chaos, and lots of floating fur. But after the race, I listened to my fearless daughter, who is crouched on her knees accepting kisses and licks from her team, recounting her backcountry adventure, and it all makes complete and total sense.
Julie Buckles is the author of Paddling to Winter. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik, and it's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more online at wisconsinlife.org.
Joining us now to tell us more about the Apostle Island Sled Dog Race is Kelly Linehan, Marketing and Events Manager for the Bayfield Chamber and Visitor Bureau. Kelly, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about the history of this sled dog race?
Sure. So we're in our 21st year, and that little excerpt that you played by Julie there kind of, I think, touches on the history of it. The race itself started on Madeline Island, which is the largest of the Apostle Islands, which is why it's called the Apostle Island Sled Dog Race. And over the course of the past 21 years, it's moved around a little bit in the area, and now it's actually based out of Bayfield. The Echo Valley Gravel Pit, which is just north of Bayfield, and so that's where the race takes place. And it's now on the mainland, instead of out on the Apostle Islands, but you can see the Apostle Islands from many places along the race course.
How many competitors are there, and where do they come from?
They come from all over the Midwest in Canada. In fact, this is the largest sled dog race in the Midwest. Right now, we have about 30 mushers registered. Last year, we had 55, and so right now is the time when the mushers are kind of looking at the conditions, and I think we'll probably get a flood of them in this week because the race is coming up on Saturday and Sunday.
Is this just one race, or are there different tracks or distances?
It's actually a series of five different races, and they all leave almost at the same time from the Echo Valley Gravel Pit north of Bayfield. There is the longest and largest race is a 10-dog race, and the race goes on Saturday and Sunday, and it's a 40-mile loop that they do each day. So they start on Saturday morning, they do a 40-mile loop, they come back, and then on Sunday morning they go out and they do that 40-mile loop again. There's also a 6-dog race, which is a 30-mile loop, which constitutes a 60-mile race over the course of the 2 days. There's a sportsman's loop, which is usually about 20 miles, so it's 40 miles over the course of the 2 days. And then we also have the family and rec race, which takes place just on Saturday. And that is a less competitive race, and it's also for families, parents, and children. And then on Sunday, we have the youth race, which is mushers under the age of 18 only.
So if you want to check this thing out and you're not a musher, is it fun to watch just as a spectator?
It's so much fun. I can't even put it into words how fun it is. The energy at the race start is absolutely electric with all the dogs and the people. We have, in order to make this race happen, we rely very heavily on volunteers. And along with the mushers who come from all over the Midwest and Canada, we have volunteers coming from all over the country and even the world. We have some from Europe this year, actually. And so we have all these people coming from all over the place to participate in this race. The dogs are excited. They're singing. They're dancing. They're ready to run. And to see them actually take off from the race start, which starts at 10, and as all the teams kind of roll out over the course of the morning, goes until about noon, is just a phenomenal sight, and it's almost impossible to put it into words. And once they actually hit that course and they're out running, then we actually have two additional spectator sites along the way, along those loops. And so you can then head out to those spectator sites and see the dogs as they kind of come flying through as they've hit their stride. So it's a very different experience to watch them leave from the race start, then head out to the spectator sites and watch them as they're in the middle of their competition.
Talking to Kelly Linehan from the Bayfield Chamber and Visitor Bureau about the Apostle Island Sled Dog Race taking place up north this weekend. What are the routes like? I don't know if I'm not a musher myself. I don't know if you are, but are these seen as grueling routes or kind of flat, but a good distance, 30, 40 miles a day? What do the mushers encounter as they're out there?
They see a lot of different sorts of conditions, and I think this race is kind of considered to be a fun run because if you know anything about sled dog races, which it's very interesting and kind of a little bit of an obscure thing, is you have like the world famous Iditarod race and one that's kind of similar to it that goes in northern Minnesota called the Bear Grease. And those are kind of considered to be marathon races. And so they start from one point, and then they usually go hundreds of miles. The Iditarod goes over 1,000. The Bear Grease goes almost 400. They start from one point, and then they go on a marathon all the way until they get to the end. Our race is shorter. So like I said, the longest race is a 40-mile loop that is done over the course of 2 days. But they get to experience all different kinds of terrain. And so this is really kind of seen as a fun run. It's not hyper-competitive. There's all kinds of different levels of mushers, and they get to experience the different terrains. And it's really a good workout for their dogs as well.
So these are huskies we're talking about, right?
Not exclusively. That would definitely usually be the main type of dog, but there's all kinds of different dogs. In fact, there's one team that races every year. They're called Racy's Rescues, and they're made up all of rescue dogs. And so there are actually a couple of huskies in there that had been rescued from kennel situations, unsafe kennel situations, but they're not all huskies, but they're all rescue dogs.
Kelly, I got to ask, you're up in the area. Have you ever gotten out on a sled and done some mushing?
I have, absolutely. It's really a very, very fun and interesting experience. It's quintessential wintertime activity up here.
Is it hard? I mean, if you wanted to try it and you found yourself a team that you could borrow and get a little guidance, is it something that you could maybe get at least a little bit of a run in on your first try?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, we have a local outfitter up here. They're called Wolf Song Adventures in Mushing, and they will take you out. They'll take you out for a morning trip, an afternoon trip. They'll even do overnight winter camping trips with you. And they have all the dogs, and they have all the gear, and they'll have a guide to take you out, to show you what to do, give you the training and the language to use with the dogs, how to use the sled, and, you know, also gear to suit yourself up, appropriate boots and mittens and stuff like that. I would highly, highly recommend it. It's an absolutely wonderful way to get out and experience the wintertime, experience the forests, and to be pulled by under power by a team of dogs who have their own personalities, and they know the trail as well as anybody, and they know what they're doing. It's just a really fascinating, interesting, worthwhile experience.
Kelly, sounds fun. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Kelly Linehan. She's the Marketing and Events Manager for the Bayfield Chamber and Visitor Bureau. We've been talking about the Apostle Island Sled Dog Race, which takes place this weekend in Bayfield.
Lead poisoning from water in Flint, Michigan has drawn national attention. Thousands of residents there were exposed to high levels of the metal after officials switched water sources in a cost-cutting move.
Here in Wisconsin, lead is also a concern. Almost 4,000 Wisconsin children under the age of 6 were found to have elevated blood lead levels in 2014, and lead from drinking water may be a cause. Bridget Bowden has more.
Hi. Hi. Last fall, Crystal Wozniak headed to the Grant family home in Green Bay. Armed with testing swabs and informational packets, she came to check the house for lead poisoning hazards. Wozniak started helping families identify lead after finding out her own son was poisoned back in 2013. At his 9-month checkup, his blood lead levels were more than 3 times the federal threshold.
So that's when I found out about it and was pretty shaken up at the fact that it was actually in my little 9-month-old system already.
Lead is not a naturally occurring contaminant in Wisconsin drinking water. It comes from plumbing like pipes, faucets, and solder, which wear down over time. When that happens, it causes lead to leach into the water. Wozniak heads to the basement where the family is thinking about setting up a playroom for its 2 young kids.
Let's do one of these pipes.
She rubs a testing swab against the pipe.
You can see the silver solder where they've been connected. And it appears to be turning pink already.
And pink means there's lead.
You know, most moms or families do want to protect their kids, and there's just so many people that don't know about this hidden hazard and how badly it affects young children.
Lead exposure can affect intelligence and lead to learning disabilities, developmental delays, and disruptive behavior in school. Some studies have even linked childhood exposure to a greater likelihood of violent crime in adulthood. Mark Edwards is a civil engineering professor at Virginia Tech and an expert on lead and water. He says this is not a new problem.
So we've known for 2,000 years that as long as water flows through lead pipe, you're going to pick up some lead in the drinking water, and even the Romans knew.
In fact, the word plumbing derives from the Latin word plumbum, which means lead. Lead pipes were banned in 1986, although up to January 2014, lead-free plumbing components like faucets could legally contain up to 8% lead. But people in more than 22,000 Wisconsin homes may still be consuming unsafe levels of lead in their water, according to an analysis of testing data done by the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Fixing the problem is complicated and expensive. Ideally, the part of the pipe owned by the utility that leads into a home should be replaced along with the part owned by the homeowner. But Edwards says that's not required, and in many cases, utility companies will only replace their part of the pipe.
They do it because they like to tell people that, yeah, you might have lead in your water, but it's not our lead.
And this partial fix can even make the problem worse.
You're disrupting this half-century or century-old pipe, and lead rust and actual chunks of lead are falling off into the water.
That's why starting in 2001, Madison replaced all the lead pipes in its system, even the privately owned parts. Madison Water Utility water manager Joe Grandy says the program was the first of its kind and now serves as a model for other cities across the country.
I'm a strong advocate of getting the lead out and doing full lead service replacements. And I think other communities can learn from the way that Madison has done it.
Beyond Madison, though, there are still at least 176,000 lead service lines in Wisconsin, and probably many more. We'll have more on that tomorrow. For Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Bridget Bowden.
This series looking at lead in Wisconsin drinking water continues tomorrow during Morning Edition and here on Central Time. It was produced in partnership with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. For more, visit wisconsinwatch.org.
And for more on the topic of lead in Wisconsin's water, Bridget Bowden joins us now. Bridget, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So by one estimate that you give us in your piece, you say there are at least 176,000 lead service lines in Wisconsin. How solid is that estimate?
So that number comes from a manager from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency who helped us sort of estimate the number of lead service lines. It is not by any means the real number. It's a conservative estimate. Part of the problem is that we don't know how many people with private wells have lead pipes, and the smaller utilities around Wisconsin just don't have very good documentation of what's going on there, so it's just not consistent.
So if you're a homeowner and you want to find out whether you're someone who has lead pipes or maybe lead pipes from the home to the curb to the service line, how do you find out?
So you should ask your utility. Other than that, do research on when your home was built. Ask the city. There are a lot of places you could go. It's really hard to figure out, though. It's hard for us to figure out.
What years are the red flag years if you're trying to date your home?
So older houses, definitely. Lead pipes, as I said in the piece, were outlawed in, I believe, the 80s. So any houses built before then.
And now, as we all know, the city of Flint going through a major crisis right now with lead in their water supply. How does Wisconsin's situation compare?
So it's a little different. What happened in Flint was the city of Flint switched their water supply to the Flint River, which turned out to be highly corrosive and was making the insides of the pipe corrode into the drinking water. Here in Wisconsin, we haven't had this drastic shift in our water source, and we're not having an acute problem like they are in Flint. But at the same time, we do have a lot of lead service lines. And an expert in lead in drinking water, Mark Edwards, who's the researcher who sort of sounded the alarm on Flint. When I talked to him, he told me if you've got water flowing through lead pipes, there's going to be a hazard.
And we know lead poisoning, a huge problem, a tragedy in Flint. What do we know about children in Wisconsin who have elevated blood lead levels? Is that an issue that's on the map here?
Yeah, so there was actually a study released just last week or the week before by the Department of Health Services in Wisconsin that showed that about 4,000, a little less than 4,000 kids in Wisconsin were tested to have elevated blood lead levels, and that was in 2014. And that is actually a decrease from 2013, but it's still a pretty high number.
So again, Milwaukee, I've heard, is an area that could be a lead hotspot. What do we know particularly about Milwaukee and their situation with lead pipes and also how they're tracking the health risk to children?
Yeah, so this is pretty interesting. Of the percentage of kids who were tested, in Milwaukee, of the kids who were tested, 8.6% of them were found to have elevated blood lead levels. So compare that 8.6% to Flint's 4.9%. So in the city of Milwaukee, the percentage of kids who have elevated blood lead levels of those who were tested is actually higher than in Flint.
So in Flint, you've got a problem because they're drawing from the river. So in Milwaukee, do we know that it's not something similar? How do we, from a public health perspective, figure out why that is and how to fix it?
Well, it's sort of hard to tell because there's so little testing being done. And if you check out the print piece that the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism put out over the weekend, it goes into it really in depth, and that's at wisconsinwatch.org. But part of the problem is that only 20% of Wisconsin kids are tested. That's because Badger Care requires a test for blood lead for young children, and most private insurance doesn't. So we're not really sure if that spike in Milwaukee is because we know there are more kids on Badger Care in Milwaukee or if it's because the water is worse. It's really hard to tell with the lack of documentation there is right now.
Is this something that pediatricians regularly screen for at a particular age?
If the child has insurance that requires it, like Badger Care.
We're talking to Bridget Bowden right now, investigative reporting fellow for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. And your report there featured a woman whose own child had dealt with lead poisoning. Can you tell us a little bit about her story and what effect that lead poisoning can have?
Yeah, so I went with Crystal Wozniak, who's the woman featured in my story. I met with her in Green Bay, where she lives, and we went into a home of somebody she had met through Facebook, and she was there to check the house for lead poisoning. And she does that because she found out her own son was lead poisoned in 2013, and he was only 9 months old. It's likely that he got the lead poisoning from paint, but she's still concerned about water because it's harder to test, it's more difficult to find. So now she's just gone through a lot of things. She's torn her house apart, and she eventually moved to try and eliminate the lead hazard from her son's life. And now she's sort of taken it upon herself to help other families, and she's an advocate with the Lead Safe America Foundation. And she went into this house, and she brought testing strips, and she showed the homeowners how to use them and where they might find lead hazards and what they might need to eliminate.
How difficult is it to test for lead on your own like that?
So they do make little strips that it's almost like a glow stick. You snap it and shake it up, and then it has a liquid that comes out, and you rub it against whatever you're trying to test. So this works well for testing for lead paint. Or, for example, we tested one of the pipes, and the pipe was copper, but the solder was actually lead. So when we rubbed that little strip against the solder, it turned red, which meant there was lead. Water is much more difficult to test, and I'll actually get into that in my story that's airing tomorrow. But, you know, there's this standard, which is called the lead and copper rule, which lays out how you are supposed to test. And a lot of experts agree that the protocol that's required is lacking. It's sort of hard to take one sample and know if you're always going to have lead-free water.
So do you think in the wake of the Flint water crisis and what probably individual states are going to be looking at in their backyards, that we're going to start seeing increased regulation or refining of testing measures for this kind of thing?
Yeah, I think a lot of people didn't know about lead in water being a hazard before Flint. And that's you know, mostly because when we hear lead poisoning, we think about lead paint. And hopefully after Flint and after people knowing what that lead is in the water, I mean, hopefully we'll see some change.
We're talking right now about lead in Wisconsin's water with investigative reporter Bridget Bowden, and you can join the conversation.
Have you dealt with lead in your drinking water? Have you had your pipes tested or replaced because of lead? And if you encounter this as a healthcare worker, a local city official, a plumber, call in. Tell us your story at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking about the risks of lead in Wisconsin's water, and you can join the conversation.
Call in at 800-642-1234. Have you had to deal with this issue in your house? If you're a healthcare worker, is this on your radar? Are you testing kids for lead? Have you seen a problem in your community? And if you work in local government, is this a problem you're grappling with there? What to do about lead water lines? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go to a caller now. We've got Stephanie joining us from Milwaukee. Stephanie, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. What did you want to bring up?
So I just wanted to mention that I know a few years ago when I was on WICS, the Women, Infant, and Children, that they used to offer you a water testing kit that you could use to take home. And the way they went about that is they would give you the test, and you had to take your sample of the water and submit it by a certain day of the week, so that it would have time to get to the lab and be tested.
And do you know, Stephanie, if that's something they still do, or this is your experience prior?
This is my experience prior. So I'm not sure if they still do that, but that might be something that people may be interested in looking further into to see if they still do that.
Great. Thanks, Stephanie. Appreciate your call. And Bridget, are there places that you know of maybe like this one that help people get their lead tested?
There might be. I don't know of any specifics. I know that there are places, for example, the Social Development Commission in Milwaukee, and they test people's paint. But as far as I know, there are very few testing water. One thing that I'll go into in my story tomorrow is how testing for water is sort of difficult. The actual protocol is difficult to do. And some water utilities, for example, will recommend that people run their water for 10 minutes before they test, or they'll recommend that people take the aerator off their faucet and dump out anything that might be in there. So there's a chance that people are not testing correctly. They're not testing in a way that may actually find their true lead level that they're consuming.
Is that why there's been such an emphasis on paint over the years? You know, as a parent, I kept hearing about check for lead paint over and over. Not so much, I don't think, did ever anyone ever mention water to me. What do we know about the imbalance of why paint gets all the attention and not so much water?
Yeah, I couldn't tell you why, but there definitely has been an emphasis on paint and also on soil. Lead in soil, you hear quite a bit about that. It might be because it's easier to test, but there could be other factors that I'm just not aware of.
Now, you wrote about how Madison has been kind of revolutionary in all of this. It's replaced all the lead pipes in its system way back in 2001. How did that end up happening?
Yeah, so the process of replacing the pipes started in 2001, but the discussions of how to fix the problem started earlier than that in the 90s. And they considered doing treatment, so putting stuff in the water that would make it less corrosive. But they decided that ultimately it would be more efficient, and they wouldn't have to clean that stuff out later. It'd be easier just to replace all of the pipes.
And that would be what most cities do, is they put something in the water to treat the corrosion.
Many cities, I don't know if I could say most, but many cities. So then, beginning in 2001, they started this replacement. It cost, I believe, more than $19 million, and that was partially paid for by the city and partially paid for by the homeowners that had to replace their pipes. But all of the pipes did get replaced, and now Madison sort of serves as a model for other cities. We weren't able to identify any other cities in the country that have done something like this.
And just in case it sounds like it be something that would be easy for any city to do, it sounds as though it's kind of an ordeal figuring everything out.
Definitely. I mean, every person who had a lead service line running into their home had to have it replaced, and that is quite an ordeal.
And we'll take another caller now. We've got Danny on the line in Racine. Danny, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to mention that you mentioned the protocol of running water for 10 minutes before taking the lead sampling test, but that is the exact reason why they missed it in Michigan. The running of the water cleared the pipes of the settling, the lead that was settling from the water and everything. And I heard from, I can't remember what program they were talking about, how that actually, that part of some of these protocols are leading to missing the actual lead poisoning in the water.
Danny, thanks for that. Yeah, Danny getting at some of the tricky aspects of getting a decent read. Running the water in Flint, he says, made them miss it. What do we know about that?
Right. So I guess what I was trying to point out is that testing is very difficult, and in many cases, people are instructed incorrectly on how to get a really good test on whether or not they're consuming lead in their drinking water. So yeah, from what I understand from the experts I've spoken to, you should not run your water, and you should not clean out the aerator if you want to get an accurate read.
And you mentioned the lead and copper rule, 25 years old now. You say some people say it's not enough. Let's say you are testing under those standards. What kinds of measures are in place to ensure that a city is complying with these standards for lead?
So a lot of experts, such as Mark Edwards, who, again, is the one who sounded the alarm in Flint, and Flint has actually appointed him to this commission to fix the problem now, A lot of experts believe that the lead and copper rule is not cutting it anymore. And the print story from the Center for Investigative Journalism really goes into this in depth. But part of the reason that they believe it's not cutting it is because it requires very few homes to actually be tested. So in Milwaukee, for example, we know that there are at least 70,000 lead service lines. They only have to test 50 homes every 3 years.
It's not a very large sample.
It's not.
I mean, you talked with the expert there who helped reveal Flint's problem. What does he suggest? Does he have ideas for what kind of testing might actually get at the problem?
We'll see what he comes up with for Flint. Like I said, he's been appointed to this commission to fix the problem in Flint. So it'll be interesting to see what sort of solutions he suggests and if they match up with what Madison has done.
We're talking to Bridget Bowden right now, investigative reporting fellow for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, looking at the problem of lead and testing for lead in Wisconsin's water supply right now. And going back to Milwaukee, with Madison as a model replacing all of those service lines that were lead, has Milwaukee considered doing something like that?
So there was actually news out of Milwaukee just last week, I believe. The city had a plan to do some work on water mains that served something like 500 homes. They were going to, you know, dig in and do some work on those water mains. They decided after everyone heard about Flint, after everyone was starting to be concerned about lead, they actually decided to halt that work because when you go in and you disrupt the pipes, if they are made of lead, that disruption, you know, banging on them and, you know, replacing parts of them, that can actually release more lead into the water. So as of now, they've halted that project, and we'll see what happens.
So if you're replacing the lead pipes and also disturbing the lead pipes releases lead into the water, is there any sort of cutting edge science here about what you can do to replace the pipes and keep the lead from getting into the water in the meantime?
So there are a couple things that you can do if you know that you have lead pipes. You can purchase a filter. This is kind of an expensive fix, but they do make filters that will filter out some lead. You can take the aerator off your faucet and make sure there are no chunks of lead sitting in there that, you know, everything that runs through your faucet is touching. You can use only cool water for cooking and for drinking because hot water can actually sort of condense, concentrate the lead. And again, if you're worried, you can consider having the young children and pregnant women, too, in your house tested for lead.
And so looking at those options, I mean, running the water, not using hot water for cooking, running the water a little bit to get the lead out of it, are those going to be enough for people who can't afford some of the higher-end fixes?
Well, I don't know if I can say that. It's definitely not a permanent fix. The only way to permanently fix it would be to replace the pipes.
I have a couple comments here. Jean emailed us to say that UW-Stevens Point has a lab, a complete test with heavy metal for $94. And Nora messaged us to say that Richland County offers free water test kits to all new moms, regardless of income level. So some options there. As you worked on this report, and as we see the the story in Flint unfolding with the lead levels there, are you seeing evidence that people are waking up to this and that there might be a growing movement, people calling for more proactive solutions to this?
Definitely. We've been working on this story since long before the Flint story really exploded. We knew about what was happening in Flint. The local media there had been reporting it. But now that it's getting some national attention and people are realizing that this is not just a problem in Flint, in a lot of other places too, I do think that some new attention will be brought to the issue.
Bridget, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Bridget Bowden, investigative reporter for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, talking about the possible hazards of lead in Wisconsin's water.